Today? Well, if faith is so important, maybe we should talk about it.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
I will say from the outset, this is probably a two-parter. I doubt we can get through everything in one episode. In fact, I'm quite confident we cannot. But what motivates the conversation will take a bit to get to. I want to give you a heads up on where that's going. There are a lot of things we do in the name of faith that I think are actually quite the opposite of what faith is supposed to be. And because we're not good at identifying the opposite of faith, we can only think of a couple of examples of what faith is and then the opposite of that, and we think we've got it all covered. And so, well, we're avoiding that, so I must be practicing good faith. And we're just blind to a lot of the damage that we're working into our own lives regarding the faith that we say we hold. And so, I want to get to a point where we can talk about that. But that also means understanding faith with a little more breadth than what we usually bring to it. And I'm not trying to be scholastic today. I'm not trying to talk us down through an article about the nature of faith in some complicated theological sense. But from my experience, and some of that is theological background and some of it is scholarly, from my background, these are things that I have realized about faith in a certain way, from a certain perspective, that I hope will be worth sharing with you and that you'll find helpful, encouraging to your own practice of faith and to the things you want to recognize when they might pull you the wrong direction and say, oh, this will help my faith, but when in reality, they sort of do the opposite of that. So starting out, I have to do what I always do with faith, which is just give a definition. And there are definitions of faith in general that we've covered so many different times, but we've never quite covered them this way, so I'll mention it in a different way. Again, these are all the standard definitions, not the one I want to get to, but the ones we have to understand before we can get to that one. So first, there's a way of thinking about faith that just takes the components of it as they show up in our practice of it in this world. So for instance, I've spoken many times about Catherine Albanese and her way of describing religion as a sociologist and how it breaks down into these elements, creed, code, cultus, and community that give us a way of observing people's practice of religion in general. If you take those and apply them to the meaning of faith, taking faith to be something related to or inherently tied to our way of practicing religion, you can have faith that's not about religion, that's for sure. But to describe religion without a built-in relationship to faith, that would be a challenge. And so it's not hard to take those four components and identify the key elements of faith in them. So for instance, creed. And when you talk about this as a sociologist, what you mean is, every religion has some set of beliefs that go with it. Creed, the same way we use the word credo to say, I believe this or that when we offer a credo. So a creed refers to the doctrines we hold. And lo and behold, the word faith is sometimes used to refer specifically to the set of doctrines that a group of people hold. So the doctrines that we hold can be our faith. I hold to the Christian faith. I hold to the Baptist faith. I hold faith in this way, meaning we believe these certain things to be true. So that's one element of faith. One definition of faith is about the doctrines we hold. A second would be to take the word code. So remember the four words, creed, code, cultus, community. Code has to do with lifestyle, practices, behaviors. So it's the practices that define our religious commitment. If you're going to be a part of this church, you need to live this way or that way. In the old days, some people do this now, too, but I can say this now that I'm in my 60s. In the old days, you know, we had a church covenant. That was actually before my time that they were active. They had come into disrepair and were sort of passé by the time I was maturing in the faith. But the idea was that in the covenant, there were certain behaviors that were excluded and some that were included. We will practice family devotions. That's in the church covenant that's practiced at my church right now. We will practice family devotions. And then there were things you didn't do. Back in my day, it included not buying things on Sunday, for instance. Or in some of the church covenants, part of the code was not going to the movies. I knew some Nazarene churches that held a view like that. And so there were certain expectations of behavior. And if you're going to be in this religious practice, you need to follow those behaviors. If you are a faithful person, then it's going to show up in the things that you live. So part of defining faith has to do with recognizing what it does to change your behaviors. So our faith is the practice that comes out of our religious commitments. Another one, cultus, third word, cultus. That has to do with the highly symbolic kind of rituals that are associated with that religion. And more importantly, it doesn't even have to, this part doesn't have to be religious, the cultus idea, but it's also any ritual that sort of distinguishes religion from the mundane. It points out the sacredness of what's going on, hence the sort of mystery and mysterious nature behind a lot of the images. So censers and smoke and the idea that only certain people can perform these rituals and that there's a special nature to their meaning and that you have to be part of the group to participate in it and all those kinds of things set the religious apart. And it makes you a part of the faith that you do that, that you practice those rituals. So sometimes faith is in reference to those rituals. Specifically, baptism is a key part of the faith, for instance, or stuff like that. Okay, and then finally, community. And this one's a big one in the definition that we use all the time. And this is the group of which our religion makes us a part. And very often we use the word faith to mean that, the Christian faith, not in reference to the doctrines, but in reference to the people who are all a part of that faith. That faith and practice, that idea. So of that faith could mean of, you know, meaning they are also Baptist, for instance, or something like that. Okay, so creed, code, cultus, community, this is sort of a basic way of understanding faith in divided up into these different ways it can be related to our religious practice. But what I want to talk about for the rest of this time with that, as sort, you know, it's a foundation. It's what's built into us understanding this about faith as well. When it becomes less about the specific nature of our religious practice and more about the psychological component, what's in us. In the past, I've talked about it as objective faith and subjective faith, the object of our faith being this or that, Jesus Christ, for instance. The subject of our faith is us. You know, we believe that this is the case. And so when we talk about the psychological component, we're talking about the part that has to do with the attitude that we have toward, well, you know, that's what gives this aspect of faith some breadth. It can be an attitude toward a lot of different things, but it's that internal attitude or disposition of the mind toward, for instance, and I'll give you three, toward the supernatural. That's part of it. What do we mean by faith? A lot of times what we mean by faith is, what do you think about the supernatural? Are you a person of faith or not? Do you believe in those mysterious things or not? Do you believe in those invisible things or not? Do you believe in God? More specifically, that's what we're really talking about most of the time when we say it. Do you actually believe there's a God and that he is invisible and eternal and supernatural and all of those things? But the idea of faith having to do in this psychological concept with the attitude that we have toward the supernatural is one of the options for defining faith. Another one is sort of the attitudinal outflow. It's an attitude that results from our doctrine, the things that we say we believe. This one is not quite as obvious probably, but it is key to understanding what psychological faith is about. And it's different than the other one. It's not just, do you believe in the supernatural? It is, does your demeanor toward life find its shape in the thing that you believe about the supernatural or God. So, for instance, when you take Paul in Romans 8, when he says, I reckon that the sufferings of this life are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us, and so on, you know, dealing with the fundamental question of the Old and New Testament of all of Scripture, which is God ever going to deal with evil? What is God doing about this? How is he going to make the world better? That fundamental question finds its answer in a mind of faith, in the confidence that that person holds that God will eventually make things right. Not just saying, well, eventually God will make things right and this is all terrible now, but saying, you know, I have a different way of looking at life now because of what I believe about what God is going to do then. That's what I mean by the outflow of our doctrine. There is a part of our psychological faith, and it is very closely related, and in Romans 8, it is about hope. It's very closely related to the idea of hope, but it's in the concept of confidence. And again, you know, not everybody knows these things, but etymologically, fide is faith, right? It's this Latin root for the word faith. And so fidelity, fide. So when you say confidence, you're saying with my faith. That's the point of the word. And the with my faith in this case is the part that allows you to look at the world differently than you would have before. So that a person of faith endures things that a person without faith would not. And it actually is a way of describing them simply to say that they are practicing their faith. Their attitude is now shaped by their belief. And because belief and faith are interchangeable, we could mean the same thing. Well, they have the right beliefs, but we don't mean that. We mean their attitude, their disposition is showing that they have faith. And therefore, they are a faithful person in that way. So our faith sometimes is just about our attitude towards life because of the things that we believe. And then when you put those two together, so this is, do you believe in God, for instance? Are you a man of faith or not? And then does it actually change the way you think about the world? Are you looking at the world through the lens of faith or not? When you put those two together, then their consistency, when they are both held at the same level in you, that is, you know, that's where, and so if I haven't said this lately, I need to say it again, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, the word for faith in Hebrew and in Greek is the same word that's used for faithful, not just the same root, not just the same origin. It's the same word. You have to decide in every context, well, should I translate this as faith or faithful? Which one is it? And you can't, the word is the same. And if I haven't said this lately, I'll say it again. Saying that, you know, you use the same word for concepts that are distinct to us can simply mean, oh, well, we need to figure out which one they meant right there. That's fine. And we can do that in translating. But the more important idea underneath it is that in that culture that uses the same word for what we distinguish with separate diction might actually mean they combine the two concepts into one, that there's only one word because there's only one semantic category within which the ideas go in their worldview. And in that case, we might need to question whether the division of those things was actually valuable as it came into our language. I mean, obviously it's valuable in the practical sense that we can now make a distinction between the two things, and that's always handy and helpful. But not always handy and helpful when the original concept was so unified that it couldn't be taken apart. And faith and faithfulness, those two words, faith and faithfulness, are completely unified in the vocabulary of the Old and the New Testament. Everything that hands us our faith, our faithfulness. And so one of the interesting things about this, when we're talking about faith in terms as a psychological component of our minds, you know, the way we relate to the world and the things around us, is that when our view of God, for instance, or doctrine or whatever, and the attitude that flows out of that, our hopefulness, our confidence that comes out of that, that when those two things are unified, when they fit together well, faith and faithfulness meet there. And it gives us a window into why it is that the two words might be indistinguishable in practice in the reality of the worldviews of the Old and the New Testament worlds, you know, in Hebrew and Greek. Because, you know, if we really believe, this is simple. I mean, I think this is the idea that's present in both Old Testament and New Testament, and pretty obvious there. If we really believe that God is the only one to fear, for instance, if we really believe God is going to do what he says he's going to do, then of course he's the one we're going to obey when we get into a pinch. We're not going to say, oh, well, maybe I need to make my choices based on the sea monster, you know, and pursue, like Jonah, a way out into the ships and away from, I'm not going to do that. If my faith is solid doctrinally, if my understanding and psychological commitment to those truths is valid and realized in my heart, then my behavior is going to show it. And so there'll be a consistency between the two, and you wouldn't necessarily need to separate the statement that a person is a man of faith or a person of faith. And then in addition to that, say, and they're very faithful. Well, of course they would be faithful because of the things they believe. It wouldn't make sense for them to betray the commitments that they've made to it. So they would go together. Now, I put all that together, and it gives you some idea of the way we think of what faith means. So, you know, how we believe and what we practice are the two things I really want to focus on. But it's also the things themselves that we believe and the people that we're a part of and so on. Okay, so a way to understand, you know, sometimes the best way to understand a concept is in its opposite. And sometimes the best way to examine yourself, to say, you know, am I loving someone? I've had people bring this up in conversations about pacifism and moral realism, sometimes the need to intervene on someone's behalf, for instance, or whatever. And, you know, they will say, well, you know, you're commanded to love your neighbor as yourself, but sometimes the best way to love your neighbor is to shoot them? You know, that doesn't seem likely. Now, I'm not advocating for pacifism or the other, but I am saying the idea that you're loving your neighbor by killing them in a war, that just doesn't float. And how do we recognize that? Because, you know, the embodiment of hate, even in Jesus' statements or in the Old Testament, is murder. That's the embodiment of it. And, you know, when you're murdering someone, and I'm tilting the field by using the word murder instead of killing, but I mean, you know, saying to someone, you can even say to a child, if you were in the brutal old days of the 1970s spanking your children like an abuser, you know, would do in today's parlance, not necessarily in disagreement with today's parlance. I'm just saying, don't want to go down that road. The point is, this is going to hurt you more than it's going to hurt me. Well, not if it kills them. You know, I mean, it's actually, I did say that backwards, didn't I? This is going to hurt you worse than it's going to hurt me. I'm not loving my neighbor because I know the opposite of love is to kill someone. You just can't do that. And so on this, I'm saying it about faith. And again, I'm not doing this neutrally. I'm not just wandering through a morass of ideas about faith, like it sounds. I actually have a reason for saying this because I have seen a lot of people that I care about, a lot of people I think are very sincere. I have seen us take our, what is very meaningfully held faith, and apply it in a way that we believe is actually defending it, but ends up doing exactly the opposite of what faith is supposed to do. It undermines the very thing that faith is given to us for. And so I want to get there first by understanding what the opposites would be. And the main goal today is just to introduce one opposite that's different than the ones we normally think of. And I mean, I'm almost there. We're almost to that point. So let's talk about the opposites of faith. So if you think of faith in these different ways, what would be the opposite of that kind of faith? So for instance, one of the opposites of faith, and I'll start from where we ended just a moment ago, the consistency of both ideas that this will change the way you behave. And so if you have real faith, it will make you faithful. You will live in that faith and make your decisions and keep your commitments on the basis of your faith. So faithfulness is a part of it. So a person who's not faithful, a person who doesn't have faith, a person in whom you would not place your faith would be a person who's inconsistent. They're not the same all the time. They are not faithful. That kind of person would be the opposite of a faithful person. So inconsistency makes for a good example of the opposite of what faith is, because we're not living up to the thing we said we would live up to. The idea, and you know, this is by definition the opposite of faith, using the word infidelity. Fidelity would be faith. You are in the faith. So when people use the word infidel, they mean a non-believer, a person without the faith. And this is the person who's condemned to the lake of fire in Revelation 21, right? So it's a pretty good opposite to faith. These are all good opposites. They're meaningful opposites to faith. They're just not the one I want to talk about today. So infidelity would be an example. And infidelity could also take all kinds of forms. So for instance, if the faith you're talking about is the doctrine that we hold, then infidelity would mean that you believe the wrong doctrines. You believe the wrong practice, you know, the wrong instantiation of our doctrines in some credo. So instead of believing in the Trinity, you don't believe in the Trinity. You believe in some sort of modalism or something else. So that would make you an infidel. You don't believe the right faith, the right doctrine. But infidelity could be any of those things. So we could go down the list. I'm not going to take your time to do it right now, but creed, code, cultus, and community, and say if you're not part of any of those, then you are outside of the faith in its either belief or practice in the things that you're doing. Fine, infidelity applies to those. But another way infidelity would apply here is in the idea, and if we apply it psychologically especially, this becomes obvious. It's in the concept of doubt. And that's what most people use as their generic opposite for faith. Do you have faith or do you doubt? And there's absolutely, again, nothing wrong with this. I'm not criticizing that definition or opposition at all. It's a fundamental part of what it means. To have faith is to have confidence in something. You don't have to say, I know that it's the case, but you do say, I believe it. I believe it, and I'm committed to it. And when you begin to doubt, then it is your faith that's waning. So just by the nature of infidelity, doubt is sort of the principal opposition that we run to. It's automatic. If you put it in terms of the practice that comes out of the doctrines that we hold, so these are the things we actually do, then disobedience becomes a really good opposite of faith. Because, I mean, I just think about the old hymn. For those of you who don't know, we used to sing these songs that were in a book and they had, you know, whatever. So this old hymn that was called Trust and Obey, and everybody has sung it at some point. Surely you've heard the hymn, but it's Trust and Obey. There's no other way and so on to be happy in Jesus, right? The trust and obey, you know, you can take that as two different things. So trust and then also obey. And that's the same way that we separate the word faith and faithfulness. But I actually think even in the hymn, the basic concept is trust and then not additionally obey, but as another way of saying what it means to trust. Obey. So the apposition to trust. So trust and, oh, you know, in case you're not clear on what that means, obey, same thing. So trust and obey conveys the idea that disobedience is the opposite of faith, and it is, and all those are meaningful as well. Hypocrisy is a form of, giving an opposite, is a way to give an opposite to faith. If you are faithful, then there is resonance between your beliefs and your practices, between the things you say and the things you do and the rituals that you practice and the community that you're a part of. They will all resonate together. If you violate the faith, then you become a hypocrite in that. You say one thing in one crowd, another thing in another crowd, or you say you believe this, but you live like that. And in those cases, your hypocrisy is a statement that your faith is, false, is a way to put it. Okay, so all of those are, valid options for opposites to faith. If you have those, something's wrong with your faith, right? Inconsistency, infidelity of any kind, like doubt, disobedience, hypocrisy, those are all great examples. But the other big opposite, and, I'm embarrassed to say, I haven't thought of this as the opposite of faith enough. The other big opposite that we ought to be having in mind when we're working on being faithful, and this is like So when I say the other big opposite, I mean the big opposite I was giving a minute ago is disobedience. If you're disobedient, you're not faithful, right? The other big opposite I'm giving here is pride. Pride as the other opposite for faith. We usually think of pride only as an opposition to humility. But if you think about all those other opposites that we were giving, they're not, with the exception of the psychological state of doubt as opposed to faith, they're not directly opposed to faith. They're opposed to it because they're opposite to an inherent component of faith. And that's sort of what goes on with pride here as well. The idea that pride is an opposite of faith has built into it the idea that humility is an inescapable part of faith, right? So, because we know pride and humility are opposites. They're the things that are posed against each other all the time. But I think in Scripture, there's something so fundamentally important about humility and about its opposite, pride, that faith itself takes on this equal role in being the opposite of proud or prideful. And so, and again, I'm not trying to read into this something so that I can create some new idea that's worth, you know, spending a few minutes on. There's a specific reason I'm going down the road this way, and it provoked in me an awareness of things that have always seemed off to me, just a little, just weird to me. Like God's attitude toward pride is oddly harsh. I mean, it's shockingly harsh. I mean, it's like, okay, I get it. You're going to judge harshly murderers. You're going to judge harshly those who have slaughtered entire people groups. And, oh, you know, that guy is a little flashy there. I'm going to throw him into, why? I don't like pride either, but I mean, a character flaw doesn't quite seem the same as genocide, right? I mean, so, but the descriptions in the Bible are pretty explicit. Proverbs 3 puts it this way, toward, and the scorners in this case are the proud. This is the idea of the proud. Even in Psalm 1, by the way, the idea of scorners is people who are willing to stand aloof and above others and point their finger at them and mock them for being less than they are. That's the idea. That's why scorn and humility are put in opposition to each other so regularly. So anyway, in Proverbs 3, the way it translates it in the ESV is toward the scorners, he is scornful. He exalts himself and points down at them and mocks them. But to the humble, he gives favor. That's the passage. This is not a one-off passage. I mean, in the New Testament, this is the thing James and Peter are pointing back to when they say, like James in James 4, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. I mean, he's picking how God identifies the people who are his enemy, and it's because they're proud, and how God identifies the people that he's going to give grace to. And again, you can see how intertwined humility and faith are at this point. James is not void of the language of faith. He talks about faith regularly, and there's no missing that grace and faith are the things that measure this distribution of God's goodness toward man. You know, we're saved by grace through faith, in the words of Paul in the letter to the Ephesians. So in this statement, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. There's something spectacularly significant about pride that puts it into this category. In 1 Peter 5, the same language, clothe yourselves, all of you, with humility one toward one another, for, and then the idea is quoting the Old Testament, God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble, an important idea that's coming forward into the New Testament. Back in Proverbs, again, the place that makes this so obvious, everyone who's arrogant in heart, the proud, you know, arrogant in heart, everyone who is arrogant in heart is, what, stumbling in their character development, slightly deficient in a virtue that God wishes they had? No. I mean, it says everyone who is arrogant in heart, this is Proverbs 16:5, is an abomination to Yahweh be assured he will not go unpunished. And that's very strong language for something we normally think of as just a bit of a character flaw. You know, he didn't get slapped around enough when he was a kid, and so he's a little proud, you know, or something like that. It's even, it even becomes more obvious in the language of, you know, the eternal and the way God sees the opponents to him. In Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, passages that traditionally and historically were assigned to Lucifer, Satan, you know, the fall of Satan from heaven, and I think meaningfully so, they are clearly about, you know, human beings on the earth. But the language about those human beings, the king of Tyre, for instance, the language about them is being given to us metaphorically to relate to this eternal fall of the creature that is the opponent of God. And so the idea of Satan is not wrong to apply here. And how are they described? How are these kings described when they're despised? How is the metaphor of the eternal one who is despised by God? How are they described? So in Isaiah 14, this is the language. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. I mean, this is an obliteration in judgment of this character. You said in your heart, and this is the character of pride being described, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. And yeah, of course, obviously, we're thinking all the way back to the Tower of Babel, right? So I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. All of this having to do with that ascension and putting myself above others in this position that allows for, you know, pride. That's the whole point. He's more explicit, actually using the word in Ezekiel 28, a parallel passage condemning a king, but again, using the language of the eternally fallen one, you know. So Ezekiel 28, the word of the Lord came to me. This is the very beginning of the chapter. Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says Yahweh, the Lord God, because your heart is proud. And then he describes all the things he's done in his pride. You have said, I am God. I sit in the seat of the gods, in the heart of the seas. Yet you are a man. Just a man and no God. Though you make your heart like the heart of a God, you were an anointed guardian cherub. You can see why he's bringing in this eternal language to talk about this king that's fallen, but reasonably is also describing the nature of the eternal fall. I placed you. You were on the holy mountain of God, he says, in the midst of the stones of fire. You walked. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till unrighteousness was found in you. What's the unrighteousness? In the abundance of your trade, you were filled with violence in your midst, and you sinned. So I cast you as a profane thing from the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O guardian cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was proud because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. So I cast you to the ground. I exposed you before kings to feast their eyes on you. The point he's making about pride is so significant. I mean, if this, and you know, this is why John Milton puts pride at the center of what causes Satan to rise up against God. You know, to make the declaration better, as we summarize or paraphrase it, better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. You know, that language is pure pride. That is so built into the opposition to what a faithful person would be, a person who is what God is looking for, whose demeanor toward God and toward the world around us is what God expects from us. By implication, it makes faith and humility inseparable, if not indistinguishable. I'm not going to say they're indistinguishable yet. I just, they are inseparable, though. There's no doubt. One may be a subset of the other. Maybe that's all it is. But I think it's arguable that they could be indistinguishable from each other. So, you know, and this is, by the way, this is why I put my doctrine together and understand my soteriology, the nature of salvation and how it happens, you know, it's important to me that faith is not a work. And it seems obvious from all of the language of Scripture that no one is supposed to take the faith that a man has, not talking about the work of God to bring about faith in that man, but the faith that a man has, nobody's supposed to take that as some kind of good work. It's not a work. It's a statement of humility. I am crushed under the weight of my own inability, my own impotence, my inability to do anything that would be acceptable. And so I call out to God in faith, acknowledging that I have no hope of my own. That's why faith can't be a work, even if, and this is a big if in people's different soteriologies, that's fine. I'm okay on both sides of the soteriological argument. I have my side. The other side's fine, too. You're welcome into heaven. I know you were concerned about my opinion about that. Anyway, even if a person were to bring faith to salvation, it wouldn't be a work because it is a declaration of utter dependence, contrition, not a good work, not a meritorious position to be, simply an acknowledgement of complete and utter failure. And in fact, in the acknowledgement of it is built in the recognition that there's no merit that would make this possibly obtained by us. That's, and the reason all of this came to mind, for those of you who listened to all the episodes, may the Lord bless your heart for getting through them. I just pause and think. There are people who do that. That's amazing. There are a lot more people who listen to this than I actually thought for a while. So I'm really grateful for that. Anyway, to get back to the point, if you heard Psalm 86 recently, and we talked through that one, maybe the last episode, I'm not sure what order they were recorded in, but the point is, in Psalm 86, you know, I was compelled to deal with that. There is, in reality, no way to see someone else in need of judgment. And to be clear, they need judgment. They actually do need judgment. And in that psalm, there's never a backing off of the reality that they need judgment. They are trying to destroy God's anointed one, the Messiah, in that passage in Psalm 86. And yet, in that very psalm, there is no room for David himself, the author of that psalm, there's no room for him to go from saying, these people are destroying me and I trust in you, God. There's no room for him to go from that to saying, and thank heavens you're a judgmental God and you will judge them. Even though God is able to judge and it is righteous for him to do so. And ultimately, as Scripture reveals, he will judge some people. This is what's going to happen. With all of that being true, there's still no room for David to move from saying they need judgment to saying, and you will judge them. But instead, there's room for him only to do this, to see someone else in need of judgment and then remember his own need for the same. He's forced into a position where the best he can hope for is not God's judgmental intervention to rule out the wicked, but God's gracious intervention to preserve him. That's the most he can do. And that's what faith brings in us. Our moments of doubt and anxiety and fear and all of the things that prompt us to pray meaningfully, validly, how long, Lord, until you come and avenge us of all of the adversaries we faced and so on. Those are prayers that come in our doubt, in our wondering, in our questioning. The prayers that come from our faith convert in the middle. How long, O Lord, until I see the grace that you've poured out on me to protect me, to comfort me, to redeem me from the place I am right now? Psalm 86 sort of forced me to recognize that, to see it in the mirror and recognize how seldom, you know, my prayers end that way as well. And the only way, by the way, the only way we could see someone else in need of judgment and think, okay, God, judge them. It's time to judge them. Think about it. Absolutely the only way you could pray that way is if you were to see yourself, and I'll put myself in the category because I've done it plenty of times, if we were to see ourselves above the one we're condemning. If you can't do that, then you can't pray for God to judge them. You have to be saying, and I'm above them, so God, flood the world to 8 feet because I'm at 9 feet and I think I'm going to be okay. The moment empathy kicks in, or the moment a little humility kicks in and you recognize that we're all in the same level. We're all in this position of being condemned. Even just remembering that we needed to be condemned. The whole demeanor has to change to one where our faith demands that we be humble and that all we do is accept in gratitude the grace that God had when he didn't drown us. That's my point. And this is where I wanted to get today, because here's where I want to go next time. And I want to give specific examples. I want to talk about cases where we really think we're helping our faith. We're strengthening our faith. We're establishing the ability of people to come to God in faith because of certain things that we practice, ways that we argue for things, ways that we try to say, oh, I could never believe that. I could never hold that view. But in reality, those views are only promoting our own pride. They're only creating in us an ability to solidify ourselves on our own ground, not in a place where we're forced to our knees before God. And so what I want to talk about next time, the thing I want to build on, is where pride creeps into our way of thinking. And, you know, we're all susceptible to this. We can't pretend we're not. Where pride creeps into our way of thinking and starts to replace what is supposed to be in us, faith. That's what I want us to hold on to. Faith.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.